The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
After the death of his father, Hafez, who ruled Syria with an iron fist, there was a hope that Bashar al-Assad would be a progressive, forward-thinking leader of Syria. Following the outbreak of the Arab Spring in 2011, the subsequent Syrian civil war and the violent campaign of suppression which the Assad regime inflicted upon its own people, Bashar al-Assad proved to be just as bad, if not more of a ruthless despot than his father. Lara Marlow, journalist and writer, interviewed Bashar al-Assad when there was still some hope about the future of his rule shortly after he became president. She joins me now. Good morning, Lara.
Good morning, Anton.
I'm right in saying that there was that sense that he might be a reformer, that he might open Syria towards democracy and towards a closer union with the West back in 2000.
Absolutely. Very much so. I was in Damascus for his father's funeral, Hafez al-Assad, in June of 2000. And I attended the Ba'ath Party conference a few days later, which appointed Bashar as president to succeed his father, and was able to talk to him on the sidelines of the conference. And he was, well, as you've seen him in photographs and on television, very, very tall, thin, gawky looking, with sort of protruding ears and a receding chin. And the Syrians gave him the nickname Zarafa, a giraffe, because he had a very, very long neck. But he seemed almost shy, speaking with a lisp, and he said he wanted to modernize Syria. And he did, in fact, in those early years, let Syrians have mobile telephones and access to the internet, although it was very controlled. The internet shops, you had to go to a shop and you had to sign your name on a list, and they kept a record of every site that you visited and so on. He freed hundreds of political prisoners initially, and he also privatized a lot of the economy, but the companies and services that he privatized, he basically gave to his relatives and cronies so they could become oligarchs. So the hopes didn't last very long. He did visit the Queen in Buckingham Palace. In fact, the looters found a signed photograph portrait of Queen Elizabeth in the family's belongings. Jacques Chirac gave him a state visit to Paris and made him the Grand Cross of the Legion of Honor, which was the highest rank in the Legion of Honor. So he was greeted warmly everywhere and really cosseted by Western leaders. But the illusion didn't last very long. Very quickly, it became apparent that he was arresting and torturing and doing all the things that his father had done, and that he too would rule by fear.
And did you get the sense at the time, and when you spoke to him, Lara, that he was genuine in his attempts to change the country, or that he was just selling the West a pup?
I wish I could say the latter, but I was fooled like everyone else. He just seemed so, you know, so harmless. The phrase invented by Hannah Arendt, the banality of evil, comes to mind. I mean, he just seemed like an ordinary sort of computer nerd. He didn't strike one at all as belonging to this whole Syrian ruling class of torturers and assassins. He seemed very out of place there.
Although I assume to some extent part of the reason that he didn't seem to belong was that for a long time he was actively separate to it. He was carving out an entirely separate career in ophthalmology in London until his brother got killed, the previous heir apparent.
Well, yes, actually, he had only 2 years in London. He studied medicine in Damascus, which is why the Syrians always called him doctor. He got his degree in Damascus and then went to London to specialize in ophthalmology in 1992. But his older brother, Basil, was killed in a car crash in 1994. So he had 2 years in London, but he spoke English perfectly. You know, and his fluency, he was very proud of his fluency in English. He would give interviews to the BBC and that sort of thing. But I think it was really cosmetic. I interviewed Rafik al-Hariri, who had been prime minister of Lebanon and who was the best friend of Jacques Chirac, in January of 2005, and a month later, Bashar had Hariri blown up in a terrible car bombing with 21 other people because Hariri had tried to liberate Lebanon from Syrian rule. But Hariri said to me in that last interview that I did with him, "You Westerners, you're so naive. You think that just because Bashar speaks English and lived in London, you think he's like you, but he's worse than his father." And I never forgot that. And Hariri was absolutely right.
Well, to that point, and what you're saying about the banality of evil, to what extent do you think the kind of crimes that we have become clear that were undertaken by the regime, to what extent was that him personally actively engaged in the direction of them? And to what extent is it just the machine that ran Syria and he mightn't have been as aware as we might think?
He was totally responsible. I don't think he was turning the switch on the electrical, you know, machine that was torturing people, or you know, cranking up the German chair that broke men's spines, or whatever. I don't know if he ever went to a prison and witnessed a torture session. He certainly knew what was going on. He was part and parcel of it. It's impossible to believe that this was all done by a system without his knowing it.
So if he was equally, if not more brutal than his father, and if in later years he had Russian support, how was he unable to keep the iron grip over Syria?
Well, the Russian support goes way, way back. His father had Russian support as well. He kept the iron grip, but yeah, basically because the Russians in 2015, when he was losing the civil war, started bombing, used their fighter jets that were based near Latakia on the Mediterranean coast to bomb Aleppo. They used barrel bombs and all kinds of weapons against Syrians. And the Iranians called in Hezbollah. Basically, the Assads allowed Iran to create and manage and arm Hezbollah through Syria. Syria was the conduit for weapons and money for Hezbollah. And Hezbollah, from around 2013, 14, 15, in the midst of the civil war, the Hezbollah fighters left Lebanon en masse and rushed to Syria to defend Bashar. And so he was fighting the Islamist militants by proxy, really, through the Russian Air Force and Hezbollah foot soldiers. And they kept him in power. And finally, they were both, well, first of all, Putin is otherwise occupied in Ukraine, where he's had 700,000 casualties, dead and wounded. And Hezbollah had been decapitated by Israel in its wars since October 7th, 2023. So they weren't really in a position. They did a little bit of bombing when the rebels, right after the rebels took Aleppo around at the end of November, but their heart wasn't in it. And in fact, there are reports of a secret meeting in Qatar, which Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, attended. And at this meeting, the Iranians and the Russians and the Turks all agreed that this was just a waste, that Bashar wasn't capable of defending himself, and that they were going to ask him to leave. And Lavrov was reportedly very, very angry when he left this meeting, because it's a terrible blow for Russia and for Iran that they could not prop up Bashar al-Assad any longer.
What of his future now in exile in Moscow?
Well, it is assumed, there are a lot of stories going around that his wife Asma is being cared for breast cancer in Moscow. I haven't been able to confirm that, but it may be true. He's there with his wife and their three adult children, and it's believed that they'll be living in a suburb called Barvika, which is a sort of colony for fallen dictators. Milosevic's family lives there. The former dictator of Kyrgyzstan is there. Yanukovych, the Ukrainian who was driven out of office by the Maidan revolution, also lives there. So Assad will have plenty of company in exile.
In terms then of the country that he leaves behind, we've been discussing a lot on the station the likelihood of there being stability, or the lack of likelihood of there being stability in Syria in the coming years. What about things like truth and reconciliation? What about justice for the families of those being released now from detention, or of those who have died in gas attacks like 2013?
Well, there were actually more chemical attacks in 2013. There were as recently as 2018, there were still chemical attacks. There are cries for justice now, very much so. In fact, HTS, the Islamist group, which Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, the Islamist group which has taken over, has said they are having trials and there will be public executions, possibly a few already. But they're also calling, you know, for calm and not revenge attacks. So that's a little bit unclear. I think it is very unlikely that Bashar al-Assad will ever stand trial in The Hague. You know, if the Putin regime falls, possibly, but I doubt it. I've heard on radio and television a lot of Syrians demanding that he be brought back to Syria for trial. I think that longing for justice will probably not be fulfilled. Although HTS has also said that members of the regime who tortured and murdered, that they will stand trial in Syria. So it will be a test, actually, of the legitimacy, the respectability of the future government to see if this can be done in an orderly and fair way or not. It's hoped that there will just not be this sort of wholesale massacre of former regime supporters. Indeed, a lot of the regime supporters are fleeing across the border into Lebanon and anywhere they can go, as are some of the Christian minority people who fear that they may not be comfortable under a Sunni Muslim Islamist government.
Lastly, Lara, to what extent does the West have questions to answer? You talk about the commendations provided to him by France, the welcome provided by the UK. Should there be reflection on the amount of credibility that was provided to this man?
Absolutely. I mean, he did, since 2013, especially since the first use of chemical weapons in, I think it was August or September of 2013, you might remember Barack Obama said it was a red line. They said they would bomb Syria, and the Americans backed out, and the British backed out, and François Hollande said he would have been willing to go in alone, but the French also backed out. So everyone backed down. But from around 2013, he was pretty much a pariah in the West. It was no longer possible to ignore the massive, massive human rights abuses. I mean, more than 500,000 people died since 2011 in Syria. But, you know, he was expelled from the Arab League. He was being rehabilitated since around 2019 or so, the last 4 or 5 years. Very gradually, he was being invited abroad, allowed to go to summits. The Arab League re-inducted him in 2023. And I dare say that if Hayat Tahrir al-Sham had not taken advantage of the fact that Iran and Russia were otherwise occupied, Bashar would have stayed in power and would eventually have been, you know, talked to and just included as a member of the sort of international community. I mean, look at MBS, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, who murdered Jamal Khashoggi. And there were all sorts of statements about he would be an outcast and so on. And now you have him being given state visits in the West, and Macron just made a state visit to Riyadh. You have the president of Egypt, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, had his photograph in the newspaper yesterday with President Michael D. Higgins. And Sisi is also guilty of torture and disappearances on a huge scale, and oppresses his own people. And yet over and over and over again, Western countries just turn their eyes, hold their noses, and meet and greet these people, give them money, make contracts with them. And it's as long as we behave that way, these dictators will be encouraged to continue as they are.
Lara, thank you very much. That's Lara Marlowe, journalist and writer.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.